This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you for coming on this nice spring afternoon. And we'll try to rehearse or prepare questions. There are two lines of investigation that could be followed this afternoon. One facing Bill Anastasi's work and as a conceptual artist, and I think we are all interested in his evolution. And another would be more on the topic itself, that is, this link that he was the first to see systematically, I would say, and see as a Joyce scholar, I can say that nobody had paid attention to the link between Joyce and Jarry. And the first thing I'd like to little leaflets we had prepared. It was a typo, but it's been corrected. I saw that on the website, the announcement for this afternoon's talk was "Me Alter's Ego." It is an A, alter. It's interesting to think of the function of alter ego, since, as Mike Barsanti mentioned, we are here in the sort of shrine of Joycean studies, this place where the Ulysses manuscript is to be seen. The quote is, as you may have guessed, from Finnegan's Wake. "Me Alter's Ego" comes from a passage in Finnegan's Wake, in which, and maybe we will say a little more about that passage, in which every Joyce scholar has to admit that there is an indubitable reference to Jarry. Do you want to begin saying whether this is where you would take your point of departure in Finnegan's Wake, if you had to?
It was not the first thing I came across. And I don't remember how early I came across it. I was writing, I had found a tremendous amount of connections in Jarry to the notes and work of Marcel Duchamp. And I was working on an article for Art Forum that ended up being titled Duchamp on the Jarry Road. And while I was, and I became quite involved with this to the point of bringing 25 books to Europe, if I had to go exhibit in Europe, to carry that many books because I felt I needed them. And I continued doing this even when I was traveling. But then back in New York, in the middle of this, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning once, and that in itself was startling to me, because if I wake up and before the morning, it's always a few minutes before the hour. It's as though I have a clock in my head, dependably. And I looked at the clock, and it was exactly 3 o'clock. And that immediately, and the thought that was on my mind when I woke up is Jarry a word in Finnegan's Wake? And the sleep was finished for the night. I went and looked. There's a concordance of Finnegan's Wake, so you can see every word that's in there and what page and what line. So I went to the concordance, and sure enough, Jarry with a lowercase j is in there three times. And to be sure, it's used in the same way. It's used in a way that fits the definition. Jarry is a kind of remote word in the English language, and which I've only come across in the Oxford Unabridged, but it's there. And he did use it in a way that it fits that, but it also fit Jarry even better than it fit the definition in it. And so that interested me to the... And I had long thought that there was an enormous parallel between Joyce and Duchamp. In the most basic way, that Duchamp exploded art as we knew it in a very powerful and unexpected way with a large class, and Joyce exploded literature as we knew it. And both of those, each in their own field, was as wide a jump as, much wider than anyone expected. Even reading Ulysses, you didn't expect something as essentially inventing a new language remotely based on English. You can say that about Finnegan's Wake. So that's what started it. And once I saw that Jerry was a word, and that so many things in Jerry, in Jerry's life and writings fit these three mentions of Jerry, I thought, well, this is something surprising to me, because I had not come across in Joyce scholarship. And then I looked further into Joyce scholarship, and at that time, the only thing I came across, this was after I made the discovery of the word Jerry being in there, is Glashine wrote a book about literature, references of other literature in Joyce. And it was almost a footnote. She said, Shem, whose other name is Jerry, she says, doubles with Jerry if intended. And beyond that, I'd come across nothing. And since then, I've come across just a little bit in another book which mentions the same.
Atherton
has two or three references. And I don't know either of those people, but they knew Jerry was.
The Finnegan's Wake crowd, but these are the early scholars who went at Finnegan's Wake and found all these allusions. And
Atherton published a book called The Books of the Wake,
right,
in which he makes that very, very early claim that Shem, who is a central character in Finnegan's Wake, is Jerry, among other people, of course.
Right.
And that was followed upon by Glashine. But what's important, so this is why the title is crucial, because in the context, for those of you who know a little bit about Finnegan's Wake, it is Sean who tells Shem, that is, me alters ego in miniature, and it looks as if there was this recognition by Joyce, mm-hmm, saying that he is divided between a Shem and a Sean aspect, but insofar as he is Shem, he is also Jarry.
Right.
Jarry would be his alter ego in miniature. Yeah. And in that context, I could quote the whole, I mean, a little more. In Finnegan's Wake, you have, he has novel ideas, I know, and is a Jarry queer fish betimes, which may suggest something about Jarry's real queerness, in a sense, in all the meanings, but he was really a strange and exceptional character, and eccentric, to say the least. And also, novel ideas suggest that Joyce knew that Jarry had not only written, I think he's mostly known for Ubu, Ubu Roi, and all the Ubu plays, which had an enormous impact in the French scene at the in the last decade of the 19th century, but also his novels are absolutely amazing. I don't know whether you want to say something about this aspect, the double aspect of Jarry as a playwright and as a prose writer. Is that,
yes,
something?
Well, I think that. And I'm not sure that it's in here, but I think that it is, because it's many years since we did this. But the very quote you mentioned, he has, that begins, me alters ego in miniature.
Yeah.
Probably, because I'm an artist and not a scholar, my memory is quite, once it's pushed, then it, the alter's ego. I think Jerry is one of Joyce's, oh, okay, so this is directly from Finnegan's Wake. He has novel ideas, I know, and he's a Jerry queer fish. So I saw it on the first night, in the middle of the night. There was one of the Jerry things. And he's a Jerry queer fish betimes. Okay, so in that first phrase of the first sentence there, when I made a quick look, Jerry's braggadocio about homosexual activity, and even earlier heterosexual activity, clouds the fact that, for all we know, the guy was celibate his whole life. I mean, he was so messed up. He may have had a very short homosexual relationship with Leon Paul Fard, who became very close to Joyce. So Joyce knew all about Jerry from the Jerry of 18 years old or something, very, very early. They may have lived together. And Jerry was a famous fisherman. He pulled fish out of the Seine where professional fishermen said there are no fish. And he just startled them by, he knew something about fishing. Probably
his mistake
without,
was that he ate them.
And his main thing is he was hungry. That's right. And if it wasn't that he could do this, he would have been up against it at times. So he's a Jerry queer fish. And then also, again and again, when you have homosexuality, usually if you know a lot about Jerry and even a little bit about the other possible suspects like Oscar Wilde and so forth, you can see that it's more often Jerry. It's almost an eBay fix in Joyce, who probably had some latent, well, if you read Finnegan's Wake, the father is attracted to the son as well as the daughter. So yes, Jerry queer fish betimes, I grant you, and cantamberus, the poisoner of his word. Well, he drank ink, among other things. But lice and all, well, his characters and he had lice. I mean, he had lice and his characters had lice. I'm talking about Jerry now. But lice and all and semi-colored stained glasses, which could conceivably have to do with the fact that Jerry was an absolute blasphemer. But then under the influence of absinthe and then ether, actually had the last rites and even wrote about the last rites. And he's a guy who wrote about the virgin suppository. I mean, the most blasphemous kind of references to the Catholic Church. So he had that parallel with Joyce. They were both brought up Catholic. And certainly before drugs hit him, he was even more blasphemous than Joyce. And Joyce could be pretty blasphemous. So, and semi-colored stained glasses, I'm enormously full of that foreigner, I'll say I am, got by the one goat, suckled by the same nana. Well, the supermale, and all of Jerry's heroes are Jerry, and all of the females in Jerry are his mother. There's universal agreement on this. The supermale, who's probably, could very likely be a basis for the Superman of Jerry Siegel, as a matter of fact, a comic strip, because he, when he wasn't with his cape on, which was a big frock in this case, and he literally could go faster than the speed of trains, literally, although on a bicycle, he was a perfect Clark Kent. He pretended to be weak. He talked about how weak he was, how terrified he was. Perfect Clark Kent, and he was a perfect Superman, as a matter of fact. So if Jerry Siegel, who invented this cultural phenomenon that we have, did not know of the supermale, it's quite a wonderful coincidence. Because if you read the beginning stories of supermale and you read at the Superman, and so it's a whole world for someone else to look into. Suckled by the same goat, the supermale was suckled by a goat, as a matter of fact. So he says, got by the one goat, suckled by the same nanny goat. One switch, one nature makes us old world kin. Now my thought is that he's literally talking about himself and Jerry in this case. Whereas thick and thin now is two tubular jaw balls. And I don't remember the references here, but there are a lot in Jerry to this particular section. I hate him about his patent Hennessy. Now, Hennessy is a made-up word, probably, and it's referring at least to heresy. And he may be saying with the virgin suppository, with the priest who's in the whorehouse, he may be saying, you can't touch, when it comes to blasphemy, heresy, you can't touch Jerry. I hate him for being such a successful blasphemer or such a successful heretic. Plash it. Yet, am I amorous? I love him. And I really think that in all likelihood, from hundreds of other references, he actually at that moment was probably talking about Alfieri. And I think he loved him through learning about him from reading and learning about him directly, his biography, through someone who knew him very well, Léon Paul Fargue.
I think this is really important to talk about Léon Paul Fargue, because he has disappeared from view today in French poetry. But at that time, I was speaking with a friend recently about Fargue, and she has made some research about the 20s, and it's obvious that in 1920, 1922, that is when Joyce arrived in Paris, Fargue was considered the most important French poet, more important than Saint-Jean de Perse, with whom he was friendly, and more important than Valéry, who was a little invisible. Today, Fargue is really forgotten, but what we know is that he gave Joyce, even for the French translation of Ulysses, he was a specialist, among other things, in French obscene slang. So he gave Joyce all these very interesting, bizarre expressions that maybe he had learned from Jarry, because Jarry had this interest in obscene slang. And he was a good friend of Adrien Meunier.
Ah.
And so Adrien Meunier, for many years, put up with the fact that Fargue was maybe less eccentric than Jarry, but still very much an eccentric.
Not too much less.
And that leads me maybe to this novel that you mentioned, the Surmal, because it looks as if it was a novel that Duchamp had read, and it's a novel in which you have something that throws some light, and this is where maybe we need to explain this a little more, but I think you've shown this in your critical work, that since the Jarry-Fargue-Joyce connection is established, could this have meant, because so far we don't know whether Joyce really met Duchamp or heard a little more than just a rumor about Duchamp, whereas the Duchamp-Jarry connection is quite obvious, since it looks as if Jarry had invented this curious idea of talking about sexuality in terms of machines. And so the Surmal is all about a man who says that he can make love indefinitely, and he becomes a machine, and he dies from this over-machinization of his own body, as it were.
That's right.
And Duchamp, as we know, with the big glass and a number of other experiments, was also extremely interested in the possibilities for creativity, say, of these images.
Yes.
Is it something that you do in your work? Or?
Well, I have all these cribbing, because whenever you bring something up that I don't really remember that well, and it's very important, then I can go to it. The fact is that even beyond the Supermail, and he talks about it in the Supermail, but he has a short piece in which there is a robot, a female robot, and he talks about how ideal she is for travel, because she fits in a suitcase. It couldn't be better. It couldn't be more convenient. And the lovemaking machines of Duchamp are just you have this incredible parallel where Jarry is talking, writing about about her, and she's called a bride at one point, so he's talking about a machine bride. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of bachelors on the scene too, and this is a short piece, and I won't take the time to look through here. The connections with Duchamp are so clear and so enormous with certain passages which are really interpretations almost of Jarry's interpretation. So you have with Duchamp a tremendous thing, and as far as the thing you mentioned, Jean-Michel, about whether they met or not, Anne Reynolds had a salon, and he was virtually, Duchamp was virtually living with her at this time. And Joyce was very close to Anne Reynolds. So the likelihood that they did not meet is almost disappears. So as far as the personal side of it is one of the reasons I find Duchamp a character in Finnegan's Wake, and that's Professor Cervelloni, which means in Italian idler, which was exactly the accusation that Breton made of Joyce. He said, you're the smartest man of the 20th century and you're wasting your talent with Monte Carlo Bond, and which he thought was just outrageous. And what has happened is that Dove is signaling something, and it makes me completely forget where I am. Which I'm sorry. Say it out loud, dear.
Mary Reynolds.
Oh, I misspoke her first name. It's Mary Reynolds. Okay, so we've cleared that up.
Yeah, it's right. Duchamp. That I think it was
Duchamp was a lover of her, but she was in Joyce's inner circle.
Yeah.
And Joyce, I guess the point I was going to make is that Joyce, although he himself was not married until many years after they had children together, he did not, he was prudish in the sense that he did not like people to visit who were just a very quick liaison. If they weren't married, that was fine, but if it was a commitment. So he was quite regular in that sense. And Duchamp treated Mary Reynolds dreadfully. He would hide her from public. They'd go out to a bar together, but he would have her get out of the car, or he would get out of the car, so they would arrive separately. And she was not to let anyone know that they knew each other, because he was on the make. I mean, his friend Rocher wrote about that he just went to beauty like a bee to honey, and she put up with it and loved him to the day she died. I think that this explains Professor Cervelloni in Finnegan's Wake. So I'm quite certain, in fact, that he knew all about, and of course he changed Finnegan's Wake at the time when Duchamp decided to marry the daughter, the granddaughter of a very, very wealthy man. And it seemed clearly that it was for money. It lasted a few months, and then they were divorced. And it was all over the newspapers, because he was quite a world figure by that time.
But I think, and it's good to stress the biographical element, and it's clear that these were people who would necessarily meet in cafes, bookstores, Rue de l'Odéon, and elsewhere. What you were pointing out is also this interesting riddle that Duchamp seemed to have embodied for people like Breton or others. Here is somebody who is considered as one of the most creative and innovative, cutting edge, we might say, artists of the century, and he doesn't do anything.
Yes.
And there's something that may be compared with the Joyce of After Ulysses. All those years when Joyce was merely publishing little fragments of work in progress that were unreadable for most readers, in transition and small reviews, and who was obviously spending all his time thinking,
yes.
Like preparing a complex chess problem. And there is something interesting for the way we see both literature and art in the 20th century, to see these two persons who, for some readers, produced something that was a little disappointing in the end,
right.
If we compare Finnegan's Wake with Étant Donné. I'm not sure whether this is totally valuable, but one could go along with that. But at least who would be, and I think this is the term that I'd like to introduce, and then maybe we can open the discussion. It's clear that Duchamp is a sort of pataphysician.
Mm-hmm.
That is, pataphysics being the strange science invented by Jarry, and I know that it has a lot to say about pataphysics. But what has never, I think, been presented is a pataphysician Joyce, and by which I mean a Joyce who would, in some way, follow a number of problems, questions, not to say that he acted consciously in the wake of Jarry, but a pataphysician Joyce would force us to reread a little bit, not only Finnegan's Wake, but maybe Ulysses. I don't know whether you know about pataphysics, but there are still today, I think in Philadelphia there's even, maybe some people here in this room belong, but there is a pataphysician society in Philadelphia. It's still alive.
Yes.
And
very, very big in Paris.
Very big still. In Paris, in New York.
It is. Well, one of the parallels is that accident for Jarry was a deity. It was how you fell in love. And it's central to pataphysics. And Joyce made a wonderful remark, I'm like a man walking along, and I stumble on a stone, and I bend down, and I pick it up, and I look at it, and it's exactly what I need. And then there are two very direct biographical parallels. Joyce was dictating, when his eyes were bad, part of Finnegan's Wake to Beckett, and he thought he heard a knock on the door, and this is in the general subject of accident. And he said, come in. And Beckett did not hear the knock, so he assumed it was part of the dictation. So then when Beckett read back the section and he said, come in, Joyce said, what's that? And Beckett said, you said it. You said, come in. And then Joyce laughed and said, oh, I thought I heard a knock on the door. That wasn't part of the dictation. So Beckett's about to erase it or cross it out. And he says, wait a minute. And he says, read it again. And he reads it again. And he says, leave it in. Now, the nice parallel with that is I went and visited Enrico Donati, who was a close friend of Duchamp. And I only met Duchamp once, but I became very close with Tini, his widow, for many years up until her death. And she did not remember him reading Joyce, but she said, I'm sure he did. She said, I don't know that he did, but I'm sure he did. So Donati was the man that Duchamp commissioned to make hundreds of breasts, artificial falsies, for the cover of a magazine. They needed 500 or something. He was going to have an original thing on the cover. So I guess Duchamp brought him the falsies and said, could you do this? And they were close friends, and he said, yes. So he, and I was in the room where this happened. He said, this is on Central Park, South. And he said the room was covered with these delights, right? 500 falsies, pink falsies. And so Duchamp walked in, he had never seen them before, and there's just an awkward silence as Duchamp was looking at him, and to break the silence, Donati said, please touch. And without the slightest hesitation, according to Donati, Duchamp turned to him and said, that's the title. Which means that he was so quick, he realized he wasn't going to do any better than that. But it's another example of using something unexpected and accidental and grabbing it because it's better than life. I mean, nature is better than life, and they both believe that. What is the ready-made about? The ready-made is saying, just open your eyes, dumbbell, and look around you. And Joyce found beauty wherever he turned. He loved common people. He hung out with the concierges and so forth, as Jerry hung out with fishermen. There are many parallels in their biography that a whole book can be written about, as a matter of fact. Even though Jerry said death is for the common man. Right? And a nice parallel of that, although it's not a direct parallel, is Duchamp said that his epitaph should read, "It is always the others who die." So to which Picasso responded, when he heard about it, this was after Duchamp had died, and he heard about the epitaph, he said he was wrong. And everyone assumed he meant that he was wrong with his ready-made. He may have simply meant he was wrong. It's not always the others that die. I'm 92 or whatever it was, and I'm still kicking, and he's gone. So but accident is a very important part of Jarry's whole thinking. He says to fall in love is like just like a stone that falls to the ground. And he's in effect saying what Darwin said about free will. I mean, Darwin said free will is a delusion caused by our inability to analyze our own motives, thereby prophesying Freud, psychoanalysis, and everything else. And the guy wasn't a psychologist. He was measuring what animals and plants do and so forth. But accident was a divinity for Jerry, and it was a divinity for Joyce, and it was a divinity for Duchamp. So that's a real great parallel.
And I think indeed one can say this is more and more obvious now that the Finnegan's Wake notebooks are being published. Some of you may have seen this. It's only six volumes.
The Buffalo.
It's fascinating, the Buffalo Project. What you see is the literary ready-made used by Joyce. That is, he takes basically like the TLS or book reviews and British newspapers, and he copies everything he finds. It looks randomly, at times with a program, but at times randomly. And all this goes into Finnegan's Wake. All this
and ready-made. Ready-made. What could be more ready-made? He would excuse himself at a party and say, "I have to go to the bathroom." And then he'd be in the door, with the door open, taking dictation of what they were saying. And if you want to know why the dialogue in Ulysses and some of the dialogue in Finnegan's Wake is unlike even Flaubert, even more lifelike than his idol, Ibsen, all you got to do is pick, and they didn't like it. People caught on to this. People commented about this. You know, we invite the guy to a party, he disappears, and then someone catches him taking dictation when his eyes were good enough. There's a ready-made, if ever I've seen one, right? And if you want to write great poetry, and of course, I love to steal ideas. I don't know whether it was T.S. Eliot or Stravinsky. I've heard both people say. I think it was Eliot says, "Good poets borrow, great poets steal." Yeah. Well, I steal, because I want to be a great poet or great something. And one of the best things, if you're waiting for a train in Grand Central Station at 8 in the morning or whatever hour, or in Penn Station, you just have a little thing here. And if there's six conversations going on, whichever one comes to you, whatever one is audible, you write down those few words, and then something comes to your right ear, and you write, it's going to be better than anything you could come up as a poet. I give this to any poets in the audience. It's very valuable. Yeah, you're going to need very little editing. They're all there for more or less the same purpose, but they all have their own crises, you know, and they're talking about it, and you're taking dictation. I stole that from Joyce.
So maybe just before we open to questions from the audience, do you have something to say about the connection between pataphysics? I mean, just to explain a little more the notion and science, because when one reads pataphysics, it looks in French. I mean, it's obviously a pun on metaphysics. But pataphysics, as you mentioned, goes back to Jarry's preoccupations with religion, In one of his novels, one character is called God, simply. He has a lot of...
Which is him, by the way, also.
Huh?
Which is Jerry himself, in
L'Amour
Absolu.
L'Amour Absolu.
And then Faust is God also.
Yeah.
He wasn't afraid to have God in his...
Absolutely.
And he was fearless.
He read a lot about theology, heresies, and so on.
And science.
And science, that's it. And how does that... What is this strange, you know, as he says, the definition of metaphysics, the science of imaginary solutions.
Which is right.
Not imaginary right. problems. I had made a mistake last time. I had misremembered, misquoted it. How does that function, let's say, both for you in your work and in what you see in Joyce, in Duchamp, in Jarry? What kind of science is that? Is it real science, fake science, no science?
I think he decided probably that all science was questionable. Even before we now know that Newton's ideas about gravity evidently have been updated dramatically by something that they don't understand, but is not simply what he was positive he observed in the rotation of the Earth, but there are other factors. So if you read about science through the, especially now, it's much easier for us to come to the same conclusion. Everything becomes outdated. It's some are hilariously wrong eventually, and some are wrong in a subtle way. But we know so little. I think he was aware of that. I mean, I think he was aware that God and no God, to our limited intelligence, are both impossible. Unless you're a believer. If you're a believer, then everything is possible. If I had one wish, it would be to be a believer. Okay? It would be faith if I had one wish. Well, the others are because placebo. I mean, imagine the placebo. If you believe that somebody that's listening to your desires and is trying. But to a secular thinking, a God, and now Kant has this wonderful, and I'm sure he was aware of this, Kant has this wonderful series of thesis and antithesis. And the very first two that he puts, the thesis is you can't get something from nothing. And the antithesis is you can get something from nothing. Now, if you think about the beginning of the universe, from our limited intelligence, it's one or the other of those. They're both totally impossible, right?
Yeah.
To our intelligence. So I went to a Catholic school, and they said, well, it's very simple. The world has a design, the nature, this is Jesuit, but they were in Orbitines. Wherever there's design, there's a designer. Ergo, God. And by the time I was probably a sophomore in high school, I would get whacked on the back of the head by pointing out that what you just said, wherever there's design, there's a design. If there's a God who can say, let it be and it was, there's certainly design in that God. So your first premise that wherever there's a design, there's a designer, as far as I could see, you're forgetting about that. You just said it 30 seconds ago, but you're forgetting about it, right? So I get a whack on the back of the head. Or I would say free will is merely our most vivid illusion, not knowing the Darwin's. This is by the time I was a senior. A whack on the back of the head. But it was worth it. But Jarry Jarry talked about parallel universes. Mm-hmm. Now there are quite a few scientists, and no one that time, even the scientists you were reading, were seriously talking about, that I know of. Now they are seriously talking about parallel universes. They talk about, as far as they know, an infinite number of galaxies being born, and an infinite number of... Well, what does that mean? That means we've all been here before, or pretty close to, maybe a couple of you were missing, I don't know, but, you know... An infinite number of universes being created, an infinite number being... What do we know? We know nothing, zero. And he knew we knew nothing. And, of course, the most brilliant, as Socrates said, is to know... He said the difference between me and the other philosophers is they don't know a thing and they think they know something. I equally don't know a thing and I know it. And Jarry was there, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
And that was admired by Duchamp, it was admired by Joyce, and by a whole slew of other other people. I mean, Dali adored him. All the Dadaists adored him. Miro adored him. And I think one of the reasons Duchamp was sotto voce on the subject is that Picasso adored him. In the big two-volume Picasso biography, there's actually a chapter titled Life After Jarin. I mean, that's awesome, right? There's nothing like it in the whole biography. That's how much he adored him. So Duchamp wanted to separate himself. But Duchamp made a, 1914, before he decided to separate himself from everyone else, he made a formula of how to make art. What is art? And it's Jarry's invented word. It's merd, ahe is to art as merdre is to merd. Now merdre is Jarry's word for merd with one letter added. So what he's saying, and ahe is close to the French for deposit. Now knowing that he was obsessed with the erotic and said so, he said the only interesting thing is Duchamp, the only interesting thing is the erotic. And by the way, there's not a page of Finnegan's Wake that you will not, and you don't, you can look it up, you will not find, and it's pretty easy to find either the erotic or the scatological. Not one page. I didn't go beyond 200 odd pages, but I can guarantee you that's enough. There will not be a page. It's absolutely true. Not one page. So we know that Duchamp was, it said the erotic is the only thing that interests me. It's much more interesting than religion or philosophy or any of those things because it's vital. It's how we all got here. And so when he uses the word deposit, obviously the blunt male idea about sex is a deposit of semen, and that's the beginning of procreation. He's saying my way of saying fucking is to everyone else's way of saying art, as Jarry's way of saying shit is to everyone else's way of saying shit. Or more succinctly, my art is to your art, as Jarry's shit is to your shit.
This maybe needs some annotation for those of you who may not know that Ubu, the first Ubu play, began with one merdre,
which you won't find in any dictionary.
Added a second R to shit, and yes. that very first word immediately triggered a riot in the theater. People throwing things back and forth, and one can say that indeed Dadaism had been invented.
Absolutely, the beginning of our avant-garde, and also the personal thing is, I did not know that Joyce was coprophiliac when I did all this research. I only discovered it after. Can you imagine someone who was turned on by feces, as we learned from his letters, outwardly so elegant, right? And found a very unnatural sex. That the first word, I mean, I did not know that he was coprophiliac, and I'm doing all this, and I'm finding all of these connections, and of course that would have been an absolute arrow on a road sign. I mean, it's and not only that, but the parallels with Bloom. At the beginning, if you listen in my Sorbonne talk, I begin by saying that Ellman points out many things that he asks a whole bunch of questions, and the answer is always supposed to be James Joyce, James Joyce, James Joyce. And one is who has a hero that defecates for the writer? Jarry, right? In Ubu, in Chain. Who has a hero who masturbates for the reader? Jarry. All the answers are supposed to be Joyce, and every one of them, and there are half a dozen, every one Jarry fits as well or better, usually better even than the characters in Ulysses. So it's
I'm not sure whether you mentioned that, but in Ulysses there's a famous scene with all the books, the library of Blooms, and that's already
Fastrow has his whole library.
You see the library and then glosses on the library.
And it astonishes me that the Joyce scholars, particularly because it's so famous that Leopold Bloom has to move his bowels, and he goes out and he moves his bowels. There's a scene in Ubu Unchained. Not only does the hero move his bowels for the reader, but while he's doing so, he's reading the work of a writer who actually existed, who actually lived, the French writer who actually, just as Bloom is reading about an article by an article of someone who really existed. That in both cases, that's a writer they didn't like. Jarry did not like the writer he's talking about. In both cases, the text makes it very clear that reading the writer sort of stimulates moving of the bowels. I mean, it is so literal. It is so literal that it's obvious to me that no Jewish scholar had ever read those two in the same week, because you couldn't possibly do it. You couldn't possibly do it and say, oh my God, it's not only the masturbation, it's not only but extremely right down the line. So he Joyce liked to be mystifying, but he liked them to find out eventually. And he, certain things he said. He said after finding his way, he said, it's going to keep the scholars busy for thousands of years. And of course, he's right. He's right on schedule.
The humor is something that they share. Joyce's humor, which is often not seen by many readers. I mean, it's obvious here and there, but in Finnegan's Wake, it's everywhere. And in Jarry in French is hilarious. I'm not sure how this is in translation, but I'll just quote one thing I like from Absolute Love, which is a take on a book that had just been published, which was called The 36 Dramatic Situations. And Jarry adds, the 37th dramatic situation, and is of course thinking of Christ, suddenly discover that your mother is a virgin. It's kind of strange humor.
Shame Mel Gibson didn't know about that.
Exactly.
That's why he's so pissed off.
Exactly. So maybe if you have questions, I think we've covered very fast a number of difficult texts and works. Sarah?
The comment is that at our opening, Bill had given a talk that we titled Copperfield and Mount Lafarge. And I was just reminded, or just told by Bev and Loon that we come now in a search engine slot, since the recording's available online, we now come up first for Copperfield.
We were with a friend. We spent a night with a friend who's a brilliant artist. He's a genius, in fact. He's a genius of an artist, but he could barely read. This sometimes happens. And he had not heard, and Dove and I were talking about this and passing on this thing, because somebody came up to me after the talk and gave me a wonderful compliment and said, your talk was full of shit. And, so we were talking about this. We were talking about this. I said, did you really think so? But he didn't know what the word was. So he said, how do you spell it? But he is a computer whiz, right? And so I spelled it, and he pressed it out. And we couldn't believe it. We're looking at the screen, and the third thing that came up was this talk. And then he was able actually to get the lecture. You know, I didn't even know this lecture was online. I didn't even know you could have a lecture online. But someone from St. Louis called me and said, we heard both of your lectures. They got a recording I made, which was a rehearsal I did for the Sorbonne talk I did a half dozen years ago or so. And I didn't remember doing this rehearsal. And looking for something else, I fortunately came across it. It's full of static and noise, but it's all there. And so they put that on there too. So these people from St. Louis had called me a few days earlier and said, we heard two lectures over an hour of stuff, and they're Russians, so this is all very new to them, but they speak English well.
We now have a new audience, those that are looking for
absolutely.
It fits into my other question, because in the beginning you had said that you're speaking simply as an artist, but as you've spoken, you've also seemed to assume the role of a critic or having a critical faculty. Jean-Michel and I, in our brochure essay, have called you a demented archivist. And
thank you. It's almost as good as a puppeteer.
I didn't tell you this, but in mid-January, when we had met before the exhibit opened, Jean-Michel and I had this frenetic conversation, which we said, what if he doesn't like this term? And so we had come up with this arrangement that Jean-Michel would take the blame.
Well, I don't like it. I only heard it for the first time right now. And I take great umbrage.
But I was wondering if you could speak about that, how your project to us, it seems that you're fluidly moving back and forth between art of interpretation, art as interpretation, but also the artist and the critic. And the installation at Slot seems to suggest this to us. Could you speak to what a demented archivist would mean to you and why that is a compliment?
Well, my approach to making art is based, probably more than anything else, on my own belief that all I have is my aesthetic prejudice of the moment. And my aesthetic prejudice of the moment moves much quicker than I'm friendly with quite a few artists who have been very successful, like Solowit, Carl Andre, Jasper Johns. I was very friendly with James, with John Cage when he was alive for 15 years. Saw him virtually every day, played chess virtually every day. If we were in the same city, we'd play chess at 5 o'clock. And one of the big differences is that my aesthetic, it may just be insecurity, my aesthetic prejudice moves. Maybe it's because I'm a runner. I started the quote by quoting Bruno. Now, Bruno is a hero of mine. Having been brought up Catholic, this was a monk who, right in the peak of the Inquisition, had the stupidity to say, no man can know the good or the true unless he abhors the multitude. And they burned him to a crisp. You don't say something like that to the Catholic Church. If it's a Catholic Church, it's about, well, what does Catholic mean, as a matter of fact? Not only that, he said a lot of other things. And I've been thinking about the distance as an artist, and I think that, I eat raw food. That's very far from the multitude. And that's going on for 6 years. For instance, I've been running every day for 36 years. I've never met anyone who's run every day for 36 years. Always some reason. Oh, my knee, my days, my thing. I've never drunk coffee. I've never met anyone that never drank coffee. Their mouth just dropped. Their jaw just went down. This is true of Orientals. It's true of Native Americans. I mean, I've never met anyone that never drank coffee. Well, there you go. See, why are these two guys in the same room? Right. So whatever the reason, there's a distance between me and the multitude. Although, you know, if the multitude started liking some of the things I like, I don't think I would change my likes. I don't think it would change my likes. But taste is habit. Those three words are an enormous resource, not only for art, but for life. Taste is habit. We are so provincial in our tastes, whether it's in life or whether it's in art. There are 1,000 things out there you've never tasted that you could like better than anything you've ever tasted, better than mom's lasagna, or whatever it is that's sine qua non for you. And we are straitjacketed by our tastes, and it makes us very provincial and very, we take a step at a time, we read one word at a time, and that's my thought about scholarship. Scholarship tends to read one word at a time. When I did this, I had nothing to lose. I wasn't afraid of other scholars attacking me. And when I gave the talk at the Sorbonne, I was attacked by one man. And I got an enormous ovation, and Fritz Zen, who you probably know, was doing this thing, was very resistant in the beginning, and I won him over, as it turned out. And he said an amazing thing when I was finished. He said, "Well, you something to the effect of you have shown us I don't remember exactly, something about you have shown us the narrowness of our but somebody took tremendous issue and in effect was saying,
David Heyman.
You were there, weren't you?
Yes, I was there.
And he's in effect says, everything he said is wrong. And another man stood up and defended me and said, well, what this guy just said was true.
The occasion was the Joyce Conference in Paris. The
Sorbonne, yeah.
At the Sorbonne and at the École Normale Supérieure. And this is the talk that is online, the first talk online. And when Bill delivered it, then David Heyman, some of you may know his name, who is the editor of, is one of the editors of the James Joyce Archive, and he's written many books on Joyce.
Right.
Was quite sanguine and really.
But we did have a bite together afterwards, incidentally, and I learned that his expertise was French literature's influence on Joyce.
He wrote a thesis.
So if I'm right, even if I'm a little bit right, he's got a problem. And if I'm a lot right, he's got an enormous problem. I mean, chasing the mite and missing the plank is what it would mean. But I had nothing to lose. That's one reason that it worked so easily for me, because I was in a different world. And the other thing, the other reason is that I got caught up in it and it was a relaxation for me. I think it functioned for me the way chess did for Duchamp, to tell you the truth. I could open those books at any time and then I was in a different world. And it was just fascinating to find all of this, but none of which I had read about, none of which I had, in spite of all the arrows pointing to it, it just was not something I'd come across. So, and Jarry is just a fascinating endless. I mean, any of you who read French, you should leave right now and get started. I mean, I don't read French, I think I've gotten sort of inside certain things of Jarry that if I have 4 or 5 translations, I might be able to, and some people do that, they translate if they're not linguists, but they're knowledgeable about something else that's up here, you know.
I have a question. You mentioned the word Jarry in English that you found.
In OED, Oxford Unadaged.
And what did the word mean?
In a way, it means jarring, and perfect for his name. Jarring, because he jarred the bourgeois. I mean, that's why Merdre begins. He was at that time, you wouldn't say shit in a theater, even if you're in the lobby. Yeah. You don't have the star of the thing come out and say it, and rolling the R, which was just, right.
Warhol, everybody's going to be famous for 15 minutes in the future.
Right.
Duchamp.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I did a piece that's going to show in L.A. in a few days. And it reads, "A painting of a soup can used to hang here." So it's in effect saying, even you, Andy. I mean, the fact is that, in my opinion, Andy, to hold interest, will 100 years from now be even more famous in the history of publicity than in the history of art. Because after all, when it shakes down, everything he did was a ready-made. Damien Hirst, if you go to a medical place, you'll see animals cut up. I mean, or you'll see, if you go to a fair, you'll see a spin drawing. Well, he'll make a big spin drawing and it'll sell for 6 figures, right? But it's a ready-made. Yeah, and you can't say that to someone who's collecting current art. There's an artist named Cindy Sherman, and she became famous by making large blow-ups of herself made up by somebody else. Conceptually, the only difference between that and Rosé Lévy is you can see the makeup. That is a conceptual ocean of difference, because Rosé Lévy with Henry's, he not only, you can't see the makeup, but he had a woman's hands in there, so that to make the illusion even more coming out of the frame. And I made the mistake in a collector who had a number of these 6-figure photographs on the wall. She overheard me saying to an artist friend, Dorothea Rockman, I said, I wonder, as we're going into dinner, I said, I wonder if 50 years from now, Cindy Sherman will be a footnote to Rosé Lévy, or whether Rosé Lévy will be a footnote to Cindy Sherman. And the art world is just marvelous. It's total amnesia, not partial amnesia, total. You will go to Chelsea and you will see 4th generation rehash is selling for 6 figures. And any artist in here know this.
Doesn't it change that the idea, it's not a ready-made anymore, the moment you remove it from its environment or trim a word or decide when to stop writing it down, the idea of Joyce sitting in the bathroom, writing down verbal waste, condensing it, putting in these massive volumes of density, and we're still masticating 100 years later,
right.
Is kind of funny, given, you know. But also the idea that when people take, you know, a ready-made 6 feet across isn't a ready-made, it's a, you know, a stolen object or something else.
Right.
I mean, otherwise everyone would, I mean, it's only your own individual filters and neuroses that might make you decide that, you know, any musician in the world would be cowed by just listening to frogs and you know, you just sit down and shut up, but I'm done.
That's what Cage said. That was his revolution. He pushed the ready-made into 4 minutes and 33 seconds. But Duchamp, who said that the title is the most important part of a work, that was his alteration. They were all titled. He claims he forgot the title to the ready-made, which I do not believe for a minute. And I could write a whole essay on that. I do not believe it for a minute. Someone who said to me, and it fits too many other reasons, that he would want to forget it, quote unquote. But of course, by putting the title, and also, not only was the title literature and altering the ready-made, some were altered physically and some were only altered with a title, but he was writing nonsense before Joyce. There's only one person who was writing nonsense before all of them in English, and this was in English in Duchamp's case, as well as in French. He did both, and that was, of course, the great, great genius, Lewis Carroll. But even Gertrude Stein's repetition and difficult text was probably around the same time that Duchamp wrote some text that scooped Finnegan's Wake, in the sense of a difficult text and the one thing that Jarry and Joyce and Duchamp all had in common is in their best work, and in The Large Glass and in Finnegan's Wake, which I think is the best work, and that no one agrees, but well, some people do agree, is a total, total indifference to the audience. In any way that we ever discovered it, you know, except in Lewis Carroll. And the reason is excellent. Lewis Carroll was not writing for a big audience, he was writing for an extremely small audience. In his best work, he was writing for Alice, who he was probably in love with innocently to his own, for all we know. The guy was probably as celibate as Jarry. I mean, there are other parallels there. But the fact is, the only thing we have in English before, and that precedes also the Russians at the time of the revolution who were writing their nonsense, the only thing that I know of that precedes it, if you leave out Aristophanes, but in English, Lewis Carroll is someone to look at as someone who foresaw, in a way, all this without giving a thought to it at all, I'm sure.
I agree on the whole, but perhaps this notion of not caring for an audience, with Joyce, there was nevertheless the fact that in the 30s, he had found a Parisian audience with the transition group.
Yes.
And I think it's very important to see maybe some limitations of Finnegan's Wake, being the limitations of the philosophy of that group,
right.
Like Jolas and the others, who all believed that Joyce was the leader, Stein was a little behind, Duchamp was also in the background. They would at times have photographs of Duchamp in the transition pages, and the idea fundamentally was that it was the revolution of the world, mm-hmm. the new revolution of consciousness, and so on. And maybe, so for some, there's a debate going on about whether this was a positive or a negative influence, or whether Joyce, perhaps because there was too much adulation, he was the god, mm-hmm. really, of transition, didn't perhaps go as deep as he could have done with certain things. Somehow. That's a question currently.
Whether he was held back a little by his desire?
Perhaps, yeah.
In Finnegan's Wake.
Even in Finnegan's
Wake. Because no one liked it, essentially. I mean, who were paying the bills didn't like it.
Yeah, but those people loved Finnegan's Wake. Jolas and so on,
yes.
It's the model.
Right.
It's, you have to follow Joyce. So Joyce was a sort of prophet,
right.
for the new technique of the Gesamtkunstwerk with language being totally recreated, and also the visual aspect of the arts was there. At least it is a context in which you could also integrate the Jarry, Duchamp, Joyce trinity within that little audience of international artists who would all generally speak and write in several languages, generally French, German, and English, at times Spanish. And so this is forgotten as well today, but it was less bizarre then, at least seen in that context. If you read Transition and see that it was taken very seriously, and that there was a debate between the American avant-garde, who of course didn't like that at all at that time, because it was not political enough, but there was a little audience, coterie.
Small audience. What an enormous coincidence is that The Large Glass Duchamp, according to his own words, became uninterested in it at a certain point, and he left it unfinished, unfinished. Mm-hmm. And within a few weeks, Joyce began on Finnegan's Wake. And the other interesting thing to show what a protege Duchamp was, he was 4 or 5 years younger than Joyce. So that he really was, that of course makes it even more pronounced, that he started this thing that was unprecedented in the history of art, and he was finished with it. And he went to Europe, and within that short period of a few weeks is when, from all the evidence, Joyce began Finnegan's Wake. And there's a line in Finnegan's Wake where he says, it's coming, glass cracking. There's one of the 100-letter words, and then after it says, it's coming, it's brumming, glass cracking. Now, the fact is that according to the accounts we've been given about the breaking of the large glass, it already had broken at that time. But supposedly no one knew about it, including Duchamp. That is very interesting. According to the accounts they gave, the owner did not even discover it until later. But they assumed that when it was brought from the Brooklyn Museum, that's the story they've given. And I've written a whole thing about whether it was accidentally broken or not, because supposedly Duchamp learned about it 3 or 4 years after it was supposed to happen. And in all that time, we don't know really what went on. But the fact is, in Finnegan's Wake, and they know when that was written, they know when that passage was written, it happens to have been broken. It happens to have been broken after the date they give for the breaking of it, which they assumed was when the only time it could have broken, they said, was when it was transferred from Brooklyn to her thing. So that is of course fascinating.
But on an even greater historical scale, I would say geological, one of the more momentous bruises of history, it seems to me, is that of all the three authors, it's still only Joyce that has a claim to true unicity. As you pointed out, there's many Duchamps or quasi-Duchamps working today. There's many quasi-Jarrys in the history of theater. No one has even attempted to do work in the vein of Finnegan's Wake, let alone to have another Finnegan's Wake.
That's not true.
No, it's
not true because I'm one of those. That's how I could be so certain that it's not true. I mean, I'm writing a text.
You haven't shown it,
and it probably will be at least. How long did it take him? 17. So it's probably going to take me 28, 29. I'm not much sure.
But the time my argument back to the historical beginning of your argument, which precedes even Jarry. As a frustrated philologist, which is essentially what I am, I would say celibacy has its...
It wasn't the frustrated part I was objecting to, it was the philology part. I wasn't sorry for the frustrated part.
Well, since there are so many great success stories in celibacy, I would say in philology this can also be frustration, can be celibacy. But it always struck me that the one book that Finnegan's Wake, to me, seems to have a profound affinity, if not identity, to
Swift.
No, it's the Greek English dictionary, the massive Greek English dictionary, edited by Alice Liddell's father.
Yes, Scottie,
the development stuff, where you find these 10-syllable words from the Homer, on and on.
But in Aristophanes, too.
A unique work that cannot be repeated, nor really added to, because the corpus is closed.
Yeah, and he knew all about that. And he knew all about Aristophanes.
This is quoted in Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in Finnegan's Wake. And he knew all about Aristophanes. That's it. And so did Jerry, obviously. And Aristophanes is really the beginning of our avant-garde. As far as I know, some scholar will say, oh, no, Aristophanes was influenced by so forth. And I'm sure he was, since we know that great poets...
Since you mentioned the name Aristophanes, I can just add my own personal philological note. If you add the name of Jarry to the first syllable of Finnegan's Wake, Rive, You get J'arrive. I'm coming.
Yes,
that's so
right.
Come in.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Exactly.
And then you have Goethe and Goethe's Faust.
Yes.
He predicts
all of this.
Unintelligibility in art.
Yes, he predicts it.
The satirical poet who, when they're all competing on the hill, he says, I would like to recite a poem that no one will understand.
No one will read.
No one will read.
No, in the second part. And actually, no one can understand because they're all talking at once, which is a very great parallel with certain parts of Finnegan's Wake. They're all talking at once so that the audience is not meant to be able to decipher one word of it. And then one says, oh, wait a minute, and he's the satirical part. He says, you know what would really please me, what would really delight me, is to write verse that no one wants to read, that no one wants to hear. Now that prophesied Finnegan's Wake, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. And Aaron, something you said that was interesting about Bill being a critic. And I wonder if you're not so much a critic as a researcher, and that perhaps all of this delving as an artist yourself is not so much in the way that an academic would do it, which would be never thinking that they would invade that kind of territory themselves, but as an artist himself, who would think, how do other artists think, artists of this level, and what does that kind of mind comprise of, and what do we feed off of to make ourselves happen? And what's interesting that you were discovering, since I lived with Bill and went through this period of time and we discussed many of these things.
Poor thing.
Over the time. No, it was very fascinating. And I thought that you were kind of regenerating yourself in this, quote, as you call it, relaxation, but digging into it, because you had arrived at a certain point where this kind of research was necessary to regenerate yourself, and that something that you had discovered and shared with me was that both Duchamp and Joyce were very somewhat controlled in their approach, and that they recognized that in themselves and needed to have the kind of abandon, the complete abandon that Jarry had. Jarry had both. He had this complete abandon that almost no one had. Maybe you'd have to go back to Rabelais to see it.
Structure. And a structure.
Yeah, and a structure. So he had both this control and abandon that is necessary, and this explicit balance that you need between the two. Mm. But Joyce and Duchamp recognized that they needed some kind of injection of this wildness that they themselves didn't have, but they fed off of the carcass of the Harry to somehow get it in themselves.
He was accused. Joyce was accused of not having enough abandon by, do you remember who it was?
Well,
this is when he was quite
himself,
young.
He himself.
But someone he respected. But when you said I'm a critic, or I'm not a critic and I'm an artist, one of the things that knocked me over reading, and I don't remember whether it was Elman or the book on Nora Joyce, is that Joyce made the statement that he wanted, that he was working like an artist. He desired that he would reach the point where anyone looking at any page would know who it was by, just by looking at a page. Now, that's something that artists are striving for more than writers. In fact, you don't find writers making a remark like that. Writers, even Gertrude Stein, I mean, Mallarmé, yes. I mean, certain artists, and Jarry, were very conscious of that in certain of their works. But he went beyond that and said he wished that every page that he wrote, anyone looking at it would know what it's like. Now, I walked into, before I started any of this, I walked into a bookstore once, and I said, how many copies of Finnegan's Wake do you have? And they said, 12. And I said, they're sold. I have no idea why I did that. People to this day, they come and they say, what are all those copies? Now, I've used quite a few of them. What are all those copies of Finnegan's Wake? It just struck me, and I wasn't at that time particularly wealthy. By the way, I've been poor, rich, poor, rich. I'm one of those guys a few times. And I mean really poor and really rich. You wouldn't believe it. But that's a whole other lecture. I mean, my income went up from under $5,000 one year to paying $50,000 in tax the following year. Tom knows that artists can have a very schizophrenic existence with money. But at this time, I wasn't poor, but I wasn't particularly, it wasn't one of the rich times. And I walked home with more than I could practically carry of Finnegan's Wake. I thought, this thing is a goddamn work of art. I mean, as a work of art, this is an extraordinary thing. I mean, I expect all of you to do the same thing. I mean, if you go to the bookstore, just say, how many do you have? And say, okay, put them in the back. It's unbelievable. Look at any page, right? And then another thing Dove reminded me of, which has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's one of those accidents that's irresistible to talk about. I was troubled with insomnia, which happens from time to time. And I made the remark to her. Now, I had already read Finnegan's Wake. I'm already on my third time. I was 19 when I started. 20 when I started quite seriously. And I've been reading it virtually every day, just as I draw every day. And I made the remark to Dove that when I was awake, I could draw and I could write, but I could not read, except Finnegan's Wake, aloud in the other room. And I do most of my reading aloud, except the newspaper, and I don't read too much of that. Well, then I came across something that I had forgotten, and maybe this is within my subconscious, because I had already read the entire book at that time, and I was through it again. Rereading it, he has a line saying, looking for that ideal reader with an idea insomnia. And I thought, I thought, well, he's found one anyway. Right?
Yeah.
And of course, it's about dreams. It's about the nighttime world. Maybe that's why it works so well when you have insomnia. Try it. Any of you have insomnia?
But maybe to answer perhaps rapidly, since I represent, after all, the other side, which is the academic scholarship facing Joyce. And I think Finnegan's Wake is well known, contains so many riddles. Everybody keeps working on them. And once in a while, you have interpretations that are not so canonical, or, for instance, to give you just one example, I had a few years ago a thesis that was sent from London by a friend of mine on Finnegan's Wake, and it was the idea that Finnegan's Wake is all based on masturbation, and we know that there are a few passages, as Bill mentioned, in which masturbation seems to be an interesting, even ontological issue for Joyce. But then this woman had rephrased the title, so it was not Finnegan's Wake, but Finnegas Wank. So she would only call it Finnegas Wank. And the text, as you can see at times, as it went on, became more and more delirious and psychotic. And so I didn't really know what to do. Was that a legitimate interpretation? And I excused myself finally from the thesis committee, which was fine. And whereas I think what we see there is that it's a text, and it's a little like what Duchamp offered to us with the scandal of the ready-made. That is, with the ready-made, you cannot say with any confidence, this is art, this is not art, for instance. With Finnegan's Wake, you cannot say, this is a legitimate interpretation, this is illegitimate. There is a process at work that is infinite, and it tries, you know, once in a while you have societies, you know, David Heyman, Fritzen, and so on, who try to say, okay, this is the right way of interpreting. What I think in the creative variation on this process that you produce, you never stray away from the historical awareness that there is a certain line of descent somehow, like Léon Poulfard, Jarry, and so on. I think ultimately this is where we have to find some guidelines, that is that within a certain historical context. It's not exactly, if you wanted to try to show that Finnegan's Wake is all about Rosicrucians, you could. Sure. But since we don't really know that Joyce was interested in Rosicrucians, you know, it's the kind of Umberto Eco problem with Dante. You could try to show that Dante's Commedia is all about the inventing Rosicrucians that existed, started a little later than Dante's time. But you could do this with Joyce. It would be an interesting gesture. It wouldn't be scholarship. But I think what you do is both art and scholarship. At the same time.
Well, of course, I don't know what I do. I mean, I can't label it.
Yeah,
it all.
It's perfectly clear what kind of critic you are. You're a hypocrite.
Well,
I mean, the technical term, hypocrite.
More semblable, more fair.
But hypocrites in Latin was the word they used for actor, and it means to interpret in the French.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But not someone who interprets in the sense of gives you an explanation of, but someone who actually enacts a score or a role and reenacts it.
I have my suspicions, is what it boils down to. I have my suspicions. And they're no more than suspicions. I mean, that's all. Even after all of this, they're just suspicions, and it is something that comes back from time to time and interrupts the other work that I do. Yes.
I think it's great.
Yes. Yeah, just 1 second.
I was actually going to ask about Rosicrucianism, because the whole question of before you said it, Michelle, because of the question of metaphysics and Gnosticism and Hermeticism with Bruno, but there seemed to be some interest in secret societies, and also Rosicrucianism is interesting as a kind of first avant-garde, because as far as we know, it was invented sort of the same way that Futurism was. There's a postulation that the society exists, and then it comes to exist. But also the idea of an alternate foundation, of some free play of paradox. So, Gnosticism is something I'm interested in, partly because it's this extreme attention to the material, sort of the masturbation, feces, but also the possibility of a complicated, elaborate platonic structure that you can erect on that basis. And I was just wondering how far we could push this idea in connection, not just with, primarily with Duchamp, Jarre, and Joyce, but also with thinking about modernism, the way modernism relates itself to sort of medievalism.
I know very little about the subject of, I can't even pronounce it, in fact, that's how little I know about it. Jarre does equate all artistic, well, certainly all painting, with masturbation, and goes as far as to say, after the end of the world, there will still be a machine that will be making art. And in effect, he's saying he's going to be jerking off the colors onto a canvas. And that the need is so great for artists to masturbate that even after the end of the world, you're still going to have it happening. Right? So he probably knew a thing or two about masturbation, you know. I mean, we don't know whether he, something that does come back in the supermail. The supermail sets out to decide that you can have sex indefinitely. And he really is a supermail. Mm-hmm. And to prove this, he gets in shape. And in fact, he rapes a little girl to death just practicing. Right? This is Jarre. I mean, talk about out there. He rapes a little, you see her body, but you catch on what happened. Rapes her to death in training for this. Now, I'm sort of lost. If someone will tell me what I said to lead up to that.
I think that the question was, among other things, a huge question about modernism.
Yes. Three of them are talking. No, I've gone on to probably, it probably may have nothing to do with your question. It has a little to do with it. Three of them are talking, and one of them is Mark Coyle, who is this Clark Kent character, who in this scene is just a weakling. He's really the supermail. And they're talking about, in ancient literature, Hercules, how many times. But then someone says, yes, but that was all virgins, and so forth and so on. And they're talking about the braggadocio, about endless sex. And then the doctor says, well, there was one case that maybe you're right. In a mental hospital, there was a man who was completely demented, and he gave himself over exclusively to the sexual act. But it was with himself, so that really doesn't count what we're talking about. So Jerry had this on his mind without a question.
And in a few novels you have seen the masturbation.
And it's something about art. I mean, after all, I mean, it's something about we are playing with ourselves in a way, you know.
Scholarship and art.
By the way, Okay, just a second. Thomas asking.
Scholarship and art and Joyce's comment, the nightmare of history.
Right.
Nightmare of history.
Right.
Running history.
Right.
Experiencing as a night.
Yeah. That we're all trying to wake up from this nightmare, which obviously we're not going to. Couldn't be more clear. How's well?
The illusion of Duchamp. La machine is also broke chocolat. In France?
Yes.
It is absolutely masturbation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
clearly stated.
Right.
And he did the painting.
Yes. The first year without glass, he did sometimes three or four pages in which he made a machine of
which is based on a Jerry image. This is something that is not realized. It's Bonnard executed it for him, but it's Ubu Ra standing here like this and he's playing this game of you put the ring on top of the stick with a string, and you put the ring on top of the thing. And to show the futility of life and of masturbation, it's not a ring, but it's a ball. There's no way he's going to put the ball. And he's doing this. And not only that, but it's got the dotted lines going like this, which Duchamp has in the painting you're talking about, with an arrow going in the very same direction. It's astonishing to me that no Duchamp scholar ever came across this. It's astonishing.
I think Duchamp is a mystery.
Yeah.
For the future.
Yes, absolutely. And so is Joyce.
An enormous
in different ways.
Quality,
yeah.
After several chances,
you know. I have one last question then. When Osvaldo had proposed the exhibit to Jean-Michel and I, we had enthusiastically responded, but we had a concern as to who this audience would be and how they would read it. And we had this concern that there would be this need for a Poundian kind of encyclopedic reader who would know all of these references. And they wouldn't be intimidated by these 2,000 sheets on the wall. It ended up that it's somewhat different. The people that have been coming in have been randomly kind of moving across the walls and reading one page and then going to the other room and reading another page. And it seems to me like we've misread that issue. I was wondering what sort of hypothetical audience you had. We've talked about audiences in relationship to Joyce, but what type of hypothetical audience you had as you were working on this piece?
Well, I certainly didn't have an audience in mind. I didn't have a reader in mind. I mean, in that respect, where I was in good company, even more so. I did not have. I was finding things. It never occurred to me that anyone would read this except myself. That's why they're in three colors and black. So it's easy for me to go back at a certain point. I didn't catch on to that until a certain point. But there's so many quotes from Jarry that were married to quotes from Duchamp's notes and quotes from Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, that I was forced to go. That when I began, it was all just one color. I was just writing this stuff, and it just a fit of excitement about it. So I'd never thought it would be. And in fact, someone wanted to publish it back at the time when I did the exhibit in New York, but they wanted it edited, and I didn't object to editing it, but I didn't have the time to edit it. It was as simple as that. So it never happened. There actually was a publisher to publish an edited version of this, and it was called Exact Change Press from Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. I thought there was a question, but I had a quick response to that. Does it really belong in book format? It seems that you had it in mind that it was this.
Well, I don't think anything belongs in book form, and everything belongs in book form. I mean, you know, I don't.
You have an ideal reader.
I don't think that. I don't think that way. You do. I didn't see this as my work. That's why I was good at it. I saw it as a hobby, and I think I was good at it. I was good at it because I had it got hold of me, and I wasn't thinking of it as something to be published. The article. What happened is Charlie Stuckey, who at that time was the curator of the 20th Century Collection at the Chicago Art Institute, we got on the subject of Duchamp, and he gave me a book Now, I met him in Philadelphia. I had done this wall removal in Philadelphia. And this is a man bites dog story. This never happens that a curator of one of the major museums in the world goes up to an unknown artist and says, I would like to meet you. And I had done this wall removal in Philadelphia, which was work that I had done in the late 60s, around 1968. And he wanted to meet me, and he came up to me. And so we got into a conversation. And I don't think it was that conversation, but we became friendly, but on the phone. He was living in Chicago. And we got on the subject of Duchamp. Now, he had written a lot of articles about Duchamp. And he said, I want you to read this. And he either gave it to me or sent me, I don't remember. And it's only 81 pages, The Superman. See if you see things in there about the connect with Duchamp. And I read the book, and I called him up, and I said, Charlie, there's not one page in there that does not relate. And most of them are the two main works, the Étang Donnée and the Large Glass, but some of the ready-mades, certainly the urinal. He's got someone who destroys a urinal, right? The Superman destroys a urinal. I said, there's not one of those 81 pages that you can't make a very good argument if you go into Duchamp's notes. So that's how all this began. And then Ida Panicelli, who was the editor of Art Form at that time, who was known to be extremely homely, her face, she was famously homely. And I saw her at a performance, probably of Merce Cunningham, and I found her face fascinating. And I almost never do portraits, but I asked her if she would sit if I did. Huh?
In Sisi.
No, Ida Panicelli. No, Ida Panicelli is before Sisi. Yeah. Ida Panicelli. And she said yes. And I went over to do a drawing of her, and we got in the conversation of Duchamp. And I said, I just read this book that Charlie Stuckey gave me, and I said, there's not a page that doesn't connect with the notes and so forth of Duchamp. So then I think she said, let me see some of that. And I showed her some of the connections. I may not even have started writing, or I may have started making little notes on a few pages of these connections.
Did you know of Jerry before reading this book?
I had known simply what most people know. He had written... He was an eccentric French playwright. He had written a play, which I had not read, but that Mirdre was the first word. I knew the basic general story. When she saw the few little notes I'd made, she said, do an article for Art Form. And I had never thought of doing an article about it. And that's how it began.